Good morning, everybody. I had to write notes because I can't remember my life that much, but good morning. My name is Steve. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 18th, 2016. Today is actually day 502 of my sobriety, which is kind of appropriate because if any of you know police jargon, 502 was misdemeanor drunk driving. I don't know how that worked out. God does things like that. I'm going to talk a lot about my early life and the situations that fit in perfectly with my alcoholism. One thing I always think about, and this is something that I thought quite a few months ago. I woke up today and I didn't think about having a drink, and that's seriously a miracle. I also woke up today and didn't think about not having a drink, and that's recovery, and that's all due to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so thankful for this program. Saturday, October 5th, 1985, that was a Saturday, and I had been partying really hard. Anyways, I got put into my car by one of my friends, totally incoherent, and I took off from Terminal Island, California, from my second job. It was in the afternoon, and I passed out, and I hit a very large pole at about 60 miles an hour. Hit the right front of my car, set me into the steering wheel. And it was a 74 Ranchero, so it only had a lap belt, so I got all these brand new top teeth from biting that steering wheel, and bruised my diaphragm and my heart, and I actually should have died. I was really almost fulfilling a prophecy that I had made as a younger person. I was born in Pensacola at the Naval Hospital. My dad was a naval aviator. He met my mom in Pensacola. My father was, he was born at the end of the Depression in southern Indiana. He was given up as a baby into foster care. And basically, he was moved from farm to farm. Nobody really had money to take care of kids. So when he became old enough, basically, he was a farmhand as a foster child. That kind of set up the pattern for my dad's life. He was very successful. He was very authoritative. He was a disciplinarian. He believed in pulling oneself up by his bootstraps. He was an A+ personality. I mean, he was beyond. Loved people, but he was a hard man. Life had been. Sometimes I think that he thought life had been unfair to him, so he just figured it was all him against the world. He hated holidays because he didn't have them as a child. So when we grow up as children, my brothers and sisters, and my sister and I, we were afraid of holidays. We didn't even want them to come because he was always really mad, and my mom was always really upset, and she'd even be sick. So it was just, we had a kind of basically dysfunctional family as far as family bonding. None of us ever felt close. My mom was a typical aviator wife, stay at home, raise the kids. I look back over the last few years at my mom, and I feel that she had a lot of resentments that her life had been just taking care of kids and staying behind. My dad did multiple tours overseas, and in those days it was 2 years at a time, so she was left with the kids. My dad, you know, was off flying, dropping bombs and stuff, and having a good old time, and mom just, you know, she had to put up with us. And I never really felt, I guess I would call it love from her. Things were strange, but it might have just been my insecurities. It might have just been my own personalities. Being in a military family, we moved around a lot. So in my first, I was born in Pensacola. I don't even remember living there because it was only about 2 months long. Then we moved to Corpus Christi for 2 years, Anaheim, California for 2 years, then Bangor, Maine, Quantico, Virginia, So basically what happened is when I got into school, I would meet other kids, but then we would have to move. So I had no lasting relationships. In fact, I didn't even see the necessity of making relationships because I was always going to be removed from people. And that was kind of the pattern of my entire life. It was easy for me to just walk away from friendships because I'd never had lasting ones. I don't have any friends from high school because I left. I went to a vocational school and I left. When I was young, I was a loner. I was artistic. I was a reader. I spent a lot of time in my room reading. I loved to read, mainly because I could escape. I lived in fantasies. I lived in daydreams. I wanted to be somebody else. As a very young, I was non-athletic. I was a klutz. I mean, really, I can't hit the side of a barn with a basketball. And so my dad played basketball at Purdue, and you can see there was a little bit of a wedge between us there. And my just younger brother was very athletic. I mean, he was a varsity baseball, basketball player, And here I was, the reader, and, you know, always in my room, always by myself. I was comfortable alone. As a youth, I had a lot of issues with shoplifting. I always felt like I didn't have enough. So, and our family didn't have a lot of money, so I didn't get a lot of things. You know, we got underwear for Christmas and stuff like that. So I would want to steal G.I. Joes from the store. Excuse me. But anyways, I'd gotten in trouble multiple times for shoplifting. I was very intelligent. I had advanced classes in schools, but later on, the term does not apply himself would come up all the time. Because I didn't want to do anything. I was smart, but I didn't really care. I didn't care much about life at all. As I was young, most of the kids in my neighborhood that were my friends were older kids. And a lot of them they had families that were kind of broken up and strange and strained relationships. And I kind of fit in with these kids that were other, like, misfits. So we were kids that liked to get in trouble. We liked to do things. I don't know if we were trying to get attention, but we were a little bit outside the norm. When I was about 12 years old, my dad was a commanding officer of a squadron in El Toro, California, and he brought over a young Marine that had come from, this kid was probably 21 years old. He had come here from the South, and he had been busted for heroin use on the base. So my father brought him to our house and set me down with him and my father. And he had this young Marine tell me about his drug abuse and, you know, how he injected heroin between his toes and so forth. And I was horrified at this. I was mortified. I was a very young kid. And at the end of it, my father said, I brought him here to talk to you because you're going to be the one that uses drugs. And that was hard. I never forgot that. I said to myself, well, I'll show you. I will be the one. I will be the one. And somehow I think that just stuck in my psyche. My first drunk was at probably around 13 years old. My older friends came over my house. My parents were gone. Somehow I had a bottle of vodka for myself. And I mean, I was 13 years old and there was orange juice. And we just started drinking. A lot of my friends were over. It got crazy. It got out of hand. I had my first blackout. I drank the entire bottle of vodka. Next morning, I woke up on the kitchen floor. I was miserable. I had been throwing up all night. My head felt, I had never had any feeling like that in my life. Of course, I was 13 years old. And I was scared to death because the house was in shambles. There were beer bottles in the junipers and stuff. And of course, nobody was there except my brothers and me. And I'm begging them, don't tell Mom and Dad. And I'm trying to clean up everything, but I felt horrible. But something inside me said, you know what? You had the best time of your life because you just escaped everything. And I could not wait to do it again. I started getting, my parents, I didn't mention, my dad really was not a drinker, very light drinker, a glass of wine once in a while. He was a non-smoker, didn't cuss, just one of those straight shooting type guys. My mom would sneak, I think either like vodka or rum in her sodas sometimes. I'd walk in the kitchen, I'd see her pouring from a bottle. I didn't know what it was at first, but I'd see her pouring from a bottle into a soda can. Okay. And but anyways, after that 13-year-old drunk, I knew where my parents' liquor cabinet is. They kept liquor because they entertained people at the house. So I started drinking liquor out of their liquor cabinet. And, of course, as it got down, I would replace it with water. Or I would just throw the bottles away. I'd take my bicycle and ride them out to the Orange Grove and throw the bottles. And some of the bottles I know were completely emptied and refilled with water, and I never got busted on that. That was really strange. It just showed they didn't drink that kind of liquor. So, I don't know, someday they probably offered someone a drink, and they're like, wow, my parents were cheap, you know? They the cheapest rum or vodka. And when I got to high school, the first couple of years there, I worked hard because, you know, it was high school, and I had to. I worked really hard, and I didn't drink too much, but I had some friends in the neighborhood that were kind of like me, and we could get beer from our older friends. And when I got beer, I got things like Mickey's Malt Liquor. I wanted something that I could pound, something that, you know, I mean, Mickey's Big Mouth, if you remember, they had really big openings, so you could chug them down, and of course, it's malt liquor, so you could get annihilated pretty fast. And, you know, I like that. I really, really like that. Because it just opened me up into a kind of, I guess, the person I wanted to be. Outgoing, funny, brave, throwing caution to the wind. I mean, then I didn't care about anything. I wasn't afraid anymore. When I started driving, that's pretty much, when I was 16, I started driving. And then I could go to parties. And at that point, at first, when I was 16, I didn't have a girlfriend and everything. All my friends did, but I'd go to parties, and I'd start drinking a lot right away. And my friends wanted me there because they knew, you know, hey, when Steve starts drinking, he's a lot of fun. You know, he's this cut-up guy. We want him here. Even though he doesn't have a girlfriend, he's kind of like that weird third wheel. But I'd get drunk, and I'd cut up, and everybody would love me. You know, they just loved me. And so I played that, and I wanted it all the time. During that time, I also got introduced to drugs, and I remember the first time I was in a car, my friend's car, and this is really weird. We had been drinking, and then he says, we're going to smoke some hashish. And I like, okay, whatever. And so I'm sitting in the back seat, the two friends are there, and they light up this hash pipe, and we start passing it around. And I'm just like, I don't feel anything at all. I don't feel anything. And we just kept passing around, and so we were going to go in my friend's mom in his house, in his apartment, where he and his mom lived. And I got out of the car, and I just fell on the ground, and I just started laughing so hard. I was just laughing. I couldn't stop laughing, and they dragged me into the apartment, and I was laying on the carpet, looking up at the ceiling. I remember this, and his mom is a little Jewish lady, and she comes and looks at me. She's looking over at you. Is he okay? And they said, well, we were on the wrestling team. And she said, oh, he's just really tired from the workout today. But, I mean, that was, of course, right then, that opened a whole new Pandora's box for me. And I just, I mean, that was what life was to me. Without drugs and alcohol, I didn't seem to have a life. During this time, when I was late 16, I met a girl. And She definitely was the love of my life. She was someone I cared about a lot, and she cared about me a lot. I won't go into a lot of details, but she was a foster child, and she'd come from a broken home that was broken. Her father had died, and her mother had been imprisoned because of drugs. Her family had been broken up, so she was really hurt, and that gave me something to care for, and I really needed that in my life. And for a while, that kind of straightened me out, because we kind of needed each other. She helped me, and I helped her. She kind of made me want to be better. But at that time, I couldn't stop drinking, and I couldn't stop using drugs. And by the time I got into my junior and senior year, I was skipping school. I was getting high all the time. second period auto shop, my friends and I would go to somebody's apartment that had dropped out of school, and we'd just drink. And I'd get too drunk to come back to school. I got in a lot of trouble in high school. I got arrested once for shoplifting. Actually, it was a spectacular getaway. I stole a shirt at a Kmart, and a guy came running out after me, and I burned out backwards and reverse in my mom's Plymouth Belvedere. And, it was just like in a movie. And my girlfriend was with me, and it was like we were so scared. And I'm driving, I'm just hauling ass through everywhere. And I take the shirt and I hide it somewhere because if the police find me, I don't want any evidence. And of course, they got the license plate of the car. And, I'm at home, and all of a sudden, the cops show up, and I'm just like, why are the cops here? My dad's there, of course. And, that's what I did a lot in high school. I had a lot of problems. I got arrested for stealing gas from my neighbors during the gas crunch in 74. And, I disappointed my parents a lot. After I finished high school, I started realizing I had a lot of resentments in my life. And this is when I look back on the Army called me. And they said, we'd like you to, what are you going to do after high school? I said, I don't have any plans or ambitions, I'm just going to live life. And they said, well, what do you like? And I said, I like cars, because I like cars a lot. And they said, well, you can come into the Army and you can work on tanks and stuff. And I said, well, that would be so cool. And so we talked for about an hour, and they said, okay, we got your information. We're going to call you back. And so I waited, probably half a day for them to call me back. And I waited a while, a few weeks, and they never called back. And so I was so pissed off at the Army, I said, well, even if they call me now, I'm not going to go. So I went to automotive vocational school in Arizona. But that's when I started realizing that I didn't like things that didn't go my way. I look back at that, and that was just a classic example of me being selfish and self-centered and just taking things way too far. I did go to a school in Arizona. It was a year-long course, and during that time, I had three roommates, and all my roommates really liked to party, which fit in really good with me. I got introduced to LSD there. Everybody drank Budweiser in those days, and then one day I just decided, after a few months of being there, I said, I don't want to drink Budweiser anymore, I'm going to start drinking Schlitz. Amazingly enough, half the school started drinking Schlitz because of me, because I partied so hard that I was like the party person. It's like everybody wants to be like Steve because this boy can put it down. I mean, it was strange. Like I said, I got introduced to LSD, and cross-top whites were really popular then. So basically, for 365 days I was in school, I got drunk or high every single day, even before I'd go to classes. I knew automotive. I'm naturally mechanical, so I knew automotive. I got straight A's in all my courses, but I was drunk all the time. So, I mean, that became my way of life. I figured every day it's good to get high. I also didn't mention back earlier, I also started huffing chemicals. I worked as a janitor for a short time in high school, and I had to work with toluene to clean this lab. And I was down, we had to clean it on the floor, and I was cleaning with toluene. If you don't know, toluene is a cleaning agent, but it's like petroleum-based stuff. So I got up from cleaning the floor, and I fell down, and I was like, God, this is good. So I put the rag to my, I put the rag to my face, and for quite a few years, I would huff, I found anything that had toluene in it, and even during the gas crisis, I worked at a gas station, and the cars were lined up odd and even in Southern California, and I would just sit there pumping gas in the back of the car, and I would just have my face real close because I just like that high. I don't know why, I just like that high, and it's not a really good high. It's kind of like a sickening high, but anything that could make me escape. I got out of school. I came back. I went to work for Napa Auto Parts. Which is something I wanted to do. And that actually became a really good fit for me. Back in those days, the auto parts business was very beer-oriented. I mean, after work, boss would send you, here's a few bucks, go get some beer. I'd be off at 5 o'clock and I wouldn't get home till 10, and I'd be drunk. I was living up in the LA area. There were a lot of drugs up there, a lot of drinking. My girlfriend and I started living together at this time too, and we moved around a bit and things changed, but not a lot of details. We were both drinking and using drugs a lot. I spent a lot of time on cars in the garage and with my friends. My so-called friends were the ones that I drank with or partied with. I was selling pot for a while. I was selling crosstop whites. And that's why I had the friends, as long as I had a lot of drugs, a lot of booze, and I had a garage with a pool table. Everyone wanted to be there, but I did not pay any attention to my girlfriend. We both got introduced to cocaine about that time. That was about 1980, 79. And we both liked cocaine, and Quaaludes were big then too. The amount of drugs and alcohol was just astonishing. And I think I scared her a lot with the way I was living, because I did things to the extreme. We rode dirt bikes and dune buggies in the desert, and I didn't care. I would do things that should have killed me, and it just didn't seem to matter to me. In fact, during this time and while I was in high school, I used to always predict. I said, I will not live to see 30 years old. And I meant it, and I just didn't care. I figured that would be a good time to die before I'm 30, because I don't want to get old. And I don't really have anything going on. I don't have any ambitions. I don't have any goals. So, God, by 30, I got to check out, man. And so I predicted that. I would always talk to people. It would be like a joke. But the thing is, I really thought it. And I think it kind of made my life the way it was. Like I said, I never had long-term goals for my life. I never had children, which is one of the biggest regrets in my life, because they would have just complicated things. And with my selfishness and my self-centeredness, I would have not wanted to give up my time for that. My girlfriend left me, and at that point, that was like my reason to actually exist or live. And I just kind of threw everything out. I completely went out of my mind. My first DUI was basically a month after that. I was with some friends in my van and drinking beer, taking Quaaludes, and tried to outrun a sheriff back up in the hills, and crashed. And luckily, nobody was really seriously hurt. I got put in jail overnight, then I had to do a couple days in county. That was the first time that I got sent to AA. And of course, Rob knows this story. The first AA meeting I went to was in San Pedro at Fort MacArthur, and Fort MacArthur had these concrete bunkers because it was an artillery shelling place for World War II in case the Japanese attacked the Pacific Coast. So the AA meeting I chose to go to, which was close to my house at the time, was in one of these concrete bunkers, and I remember there was a single light on a string hanging down and metal folding chairs in a circle. And I'm 24, 25 years old, and all these guys were really old, like 40 and stuff. And they were so depressing that I came to call that the razor blade meeting, because I figured, shit, if life is like this, why don't we just pass out some razor blades? Because it was depressing. And maybe I didn't hear everything there also. I might have had some ideas when I went in there. Anyways, my second DUI came really fast after that, 1981. I was at a concert, and I don't even know what was involved, but when we finally left, my friend and I, he had driven my truck back to his apartment, then he pulled me across the seat into the driver's seat and said, see you later. And I was driving, I don't know where I was driving, and I decided to go to sleep while I was driving, so I laid down on the seat and hit a parked car head on, which thankfully, thank God I didn't kill anybody. But two more days in county at that time. But I did get, at that time I got, court mandated AA, and I probably had to do a lot of meetings. But the thing that was interesting, during this time I started going to this meeting in Long Beach. It was a real big meeting. And it was only on Fridays I went. There were like 200 to 300 people there. It was big. So I could kind of hide out at first. But then I started meeting some people, and people came up to me, and I said, you know, I kind of felt like, well, you know what? These people are nice, and I'm not, and I stopped drinking, and I was trying. I was trying really hard not to drink. But I'd hear the steps, but I didn't listen to the steps because I was just like, well, you know, these people are like some kind of cult, and this is what they do, and I'm just going to hang out here because they're nice people, and they got cookies and stuff. And it was kind of cool, and it was a place for me to go. I was living by myself. I was lonely, and, you know, I had people's phone numbers. I never called a single one. They gave me a big book. I don't have it anymore, unfortunately. They had written all their numbers in the back. I never utilized it, but I actually got to the point where I was involved in it, and I think I even chaired a couple meetings. I don't remember anything about it. I have my six-month chip that I got there. But I had a mentor who was an older woman, and the situation became strange, and I had to leave. And it was, you know, because not everybody here is good, and not everybody has good intentions, and I was young and naive, and I was excited about my sobriety, and this person tried to take advantage of me. So I instantly had a resentment, so I said, I'm not going there anymore. And I tried not to drink on my own, but I would normally lay in my bed at night and pray to God to take my life while I slept. I did not want to wake up the next day because I was not living life anyway that I wanted to. I started drinking again, and I was working two full jobs. I was working at Napa, and I started working as a mechanic on Terminal Island at Southwest Marine. That was 2 8-hour jobs back to back. So at first I was drinking some, but I had it under control. I didn't have a lot of time to drink with two full-time jobs, but I started taking Vivarin because I felt, you know, that'll keep me awake. But one of the guys, we connected there, and then he says, hey, we're going to go out and get some parts and stuff, and we stopped and got some beers. So that became a nightly routine. We would go out and get drunk because we would be the only two working together. The Vivarin turned into cocaine. The cocaine turned into crystal meth because there were a lot of welders there that worked 20-hour shifts, and meth was cheap. It was And boy, I loved it because I could go. I'd go home. I'd get home at 12:30 at night, and I couldn't sleep. And I'd get up at, you know, 7 the next morning, go to work, and feeling like crap, but do a line, and I could just keep going. Well, on October 4th, that was a Saturday. That was a Friday. And so I went to work. We partied all night, and then my friend came home because it was Friday night. We had the weekend off. We got more cocaine, we got more crystal, more beer, just kept partying. I told him he had to go to sleep because he really looked like he was wasted. And so he did. He slept for a few hours, and I stayed up all night, and I just kept doing lines and kept drinking. And the next day that we went to a drug connection I had in Wilmington, and I sat there. I remember sitting in the guy was an automotive repair shop, and they would give me a beer, and I would put it in my hand, and then it would just drop out of my hand on the floor. I was that annihilated that the beers, and they were laughing, and I started laughing. And it got so bad. Anyways, we got back to Terminal Island. I was just getting to the point of incoherency, and my friend drove my car back to Terminal Island, and then I was talking nonsense, and he let me get in the car. And that was when I hit the pole. And I should have died. I should have died that day. I was 29 years old, so I almost fulfilled my own self-prophecy at that point. I did 4 months in jail. I met a lot of people. You know, obviously you don't drink too much in jail, so, you know, I got sober. Well, people were making Pruno, and I stayed away from that nasty crap, and people were huffing spray paint, and I was like, no, that doesn't make sense, but it looks good. I met a lot of guys. And I learned a lot while I was in jail. I wouldn't go to the AA meetings, or I wouldn't go to church, but I met guys that were repeat offenders. They kept coming back to jail. And I had some mentors there that told me, I said, you know what, this is no kind of life for you. You don't look like you belong in jail. And so I kind of listened to them, and they said, you know, you need to do something, get out and straighten out your life. And so I thought about that. And then, of course, I got out, and I started drinking again right away. And Also, a week before I had the accident on Terminal Island, I had proposed to a different girlfriend, and we were going to get married. So a week later, I crashed my car. It was, it really impressed her parents a lot when my teeth were torn out of my head. We did get married. We got divorced very shortly after that because she was 10 years younger than me. She just wanted to get out of the house, and I just wanted to get out of trouble. I figured if I get married, everybody's going to look at me and say, hey, there's a responsible guy. He's married, right? No, it didn't work. Fast-forwarding, Susan and I got married again. We had been separated for 8 years, and we got together and we got married. I was still drinking really hard. She kind of wanted to fit into my party lifestyle, so she tried to keep up with me, but she didn't, and so she pulled away. I was really escalating my drinking then. Beer wouldn't even satisfy me. I had to drink hard liquor. At one point, I actually tried, craft beers were becoming really big then, and I was drinking bourbon out of the handle bottles, and I said, well, I'm going to just drink craft beers because, that sounds cool and that'll be okay. And I remember one day I went and it was going to be my first craft beer, and I was at the kitchen sink. Susan and I were doing some tile work in her bathroom, and I went to drink a beer and I took a swallow of it and then I threw up. And I said, I can't do this. I can't do this. And I had to pour myself a bourbon and Coke right there. My body knew and my mind knew that that's not what I wanted. And that's when I got really bad. And I'd always been a functional alcoholic. I showed up for work. I did my job. I grinned and bared it until I could get off work and buy a half pint of vodka and a bottle of grapefruit juice so I could make the drive home and then start drinking. That was pretty much every single day. In 1996, I was 40 years old, and I ended up not being able to go to work on a Monday because I wasn't sleeping anymore. I couldn't sleep because I was drunk. I'd pass out, then I'd just wake up at 1:30, and then I'd have to either drink or try to sleep. But I couldn't make it to work on a Monday, so I felt so bad that I drank all day. I was incoherent when my wife got home from work, and of course, she wasn't real pleased with that. But so I couldn't sleep again the next night, and I couldn't get to work. And so I drank the next day too. And by this time, she didn't know what to do anymore. And I finally said, you know what? I need help. I'm gonna go to the doctor. And I went to my doctor and I said, Doc, he called me in his office, said, what's up? And I said, I think I have a drinking problem. My hands were shaking uncontrollably. I was basically in early stages of alcohol poisoning. I was still drunk when I was there with him, and he asked me a question. He said, do you ever think about suicide? And I looked at him like, are you kidding me? Yeah. Doesn't everybody? I thought that's just what life's about. And so he said, okay, we're going to do something. I'm going to send you over to the hospital. He gave me an envelope, and Susan and I drove to the hospital. He didn't tell me why he was sending me to the hospital, but when we got to the hospital, I said to myself, well, I better look in this envelope and see what it says. And it said they were putting me in the hospital for suicide watch. And I'm like, well, that's silly. I got a drinking problem. I'm not really going to commit suicide. But anyways, and this is kind of weird. I thought I went into the hospital on April 30th, 1996, and I counted that as my first sobriety date. And I got out sometime in early May. This is kind of the weird part, and I don't know how it took so long for me to figure this out. I was going through some stuff the other day, and I found a hospital wristband that was for Torrance Memorial Hospital or whatever, and it said March 6, 1996. And so I'm like, when did I go in the hospital on March 6? So I took the wristband back to Susan, and I said, hon, what is this wristband that says March 6? And she goes, you were in the hospital for a really long time. And I just walked away from her because I didn't really want to know. But that meant that I thought I went to the hospital on April 30th, but I went in March 6th. So I was possibly in the hospital for 2 months. I still haven't asked her about it because it doesn't matter anymore. But that's kind of weird. That's kind of weird. But anyways, what happened is I stopped drinking. I got out of the hospital. They wanted to put me in rehab. I said, I don't need it. Some kind of miracle happened while I was there. And I stopped drinking. I got out. I was happier. I was healthier. Susan was ecstatic. My boss, who was a practicing alcoholic, was happy with me. And really, I don't know what happened. I couldn't figure it out at that time. I didn't need AA. My sister was in the program, and I said, that's cool for her, but you know what? I'm happy right now. I'm not drinking, and I don't feel like I need a drink. And it was weird. The compulsion was removed from me. But as I went through the years, I noticed I was always restless, irritable, and discontent. Nothing was ever good enough. Nothing really worked out the way I wanted it to. I also became excessively obsessive compulsive. I had to have things perfect. I mean, seriously perfect. Rugs had to be aligned. Everything had to be perfect. And that was part of my restlessness, is that I wanted things to be right in the world. Because you know what? It was so good now. Everything should be right. And that doesn't happen in life. So I was sober, but I wasn't quite living right. In 1999, we moved to Georgia. On the way here, I told my wife, we were driving here, and I just one night, I said, you know, when we get to Georgia, we should go to church. And she goes, that's a good idea. Long story short, we went to church. I developed a relationship with the God of my understanding, my higher power. And then I became aware that the miracle that happened to me in 96 was by God's grace. And I figured, you know, he was doing it for me because I wasn't going to do it myself. And I needed someone to take care of me because I was ready to die. In 2011, and just kind of fast-forwarding quickly, 2011, I had back surgery. You know, I've been quite a few years sober now, and life was generally good. I was, you know, having other problems at work and stuff, but I had back surgery. And I never thought of this, but they gave me a lot of narcotics. Hydrocodone, Percocet. And, you know, after I had my surgery, I'm taking these pills, tramadol and all this stuff, and I'm just kind of like, I'm really happy. You know, I'm just really happy. And I'm not thinking. I'm not thinking about my addictive nature. So I'm taking these pills, and I mean, I had hundreds of hydrocodone, hundreds, literally. I begged my doctor for more Percocet after the surgery, and that should have been like something clicking in my head, saying, there's something wrong there. But he wouldn't give me any. He said, no, we only give you the 100 Percocet immediately after the surgery. You don't need it after that. You can just take hydrocodone. I said, well, I need 500 more of those. So anyways, I had a lot of hydrocodone. Now, the thing that really should have been a key, when I got really low on them, I started breaking them in half because I didn't want it to end. And I started saying, I can only take hydrocodone every 6 hours or on a special occasion. And that should have been a clue. Anyways, I did get off them. I kind of weaned myself off them because I ran out. My wife got some hydrocodone, and every once in a while I would sneak those. In late 2013 or early 2014, I've been having a lot of issues. I was very tense at work. There were a lot of changes, layoffs, people fired that I liked. Things weren't being run the way I wanted them to be run, so I was very discontented. I went to my wife and I said, hon, wouldn't it be nice if you and I could just sit on the front porch and have a glass of wine? And she was horrified. She was completely mortified that I would say something like that. But I am the best manipulator in the world. And I explained the situation to her, that I'm fine, that I can enjoy a glass of wine now. That it won't be any problem. This would be good for us. It would be good for us, right? Yeah. And she reluctantly let me, because she would let me do what I want to do. Otherwise, I would pout. Within 2 weeks, I had to call her at work. I was off a day of work, and I was drunk on the floor and incoherent. And she had to leave early and come home. So my alcoholism had picked up with a vengeance. The expression that it's doing push-ups was real life. I could not stop. I was sneaking booze. I was buying bottles of sherry on the way home from work. Susan's hearing things for the first time that she's never heard, so thank you very much. I'm glad you're going to that church retreat immediately after this. But I would throw away bottles, and I've shared this before, I would throw away empty bottles at the Kroger parking lot on the way to work. I'd stash them in my truck, behind the seat, under the seats. I would drink like Four Locos and stuff like that coming home. I mean, nasty 26-ounce Limeritas and stuff just to get that buzz. And I tried to stop. I tried to stop, and I would tell Susan, you know what, I got to stop. I'm getting in trouble, right? So you want me to stop? I'll stop. And I'd last 2 or 3 days. I mean, this happened over and over and over again. And I think I once made it almost 20 days, but I mean, I was so mad. Everything was so bad in life. I thought my head was going to explode. I just started drinking a whole lot at night. I couldn't sleep again. And I was even taking sleep medication. I couldn't sleep. So I'd get up at about every hour, hour and a half, and I'd have a drink so I could go back to sleep. On July 18th, it was a Monday. I had been drinking all night, and I got up, and I always got up before Susan. We get up real early in the morning, and I went down, and I was like, dude, don't have a drink, and just get your coffee and go to work, and you're going to be okay, all right? Get your coffee. I looked at the coffee machine. I looked at the refrigerator. I looked at the coffee machine. I said, screw this, man. I'm having a drink. I got to have a drink. I finished off like half a bottle of wine, and I went up. I used mouthwash. I always had the nicest breath at night, and I went up and I woke my wife up, and we just laid in bed, watched the news for a couple minutes like we always did. And so I got up to shave, and I think she knew something was wrong. And I was getting ready to shave. I was looking in my bathroom, looking at the mirror. I just looked in the mirror. I couldn't understand what I was looking at. I looked at someone that was dying, and I knew it. And I knew it. And I looked and I said, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And I just started tearing up. And I felt so, I don't know. I just felt so bad. And Susan came up behind me. And she said, I don't remember everything exactly because I was pretty wasted. And she said, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm not. And I was crying. And she said, have you been drinking? And I said, yeah. I admitted it. I wasn't going to, but I admitted it. And she goes, what do you want to do? And I just looked at the mirror of myself, and some glimmer of hope was still in those eyes that I saw, but not much. And I said, I need help. And I thank her that she got me into a rehab that same day. I ended up a rehab up in Ball Ground, and it was good. It was a 12-step program-based rehab, which really... I bit into that thing full force. When I got there the first day, I made sure I drank a lot before I got there. She didn't know, but every time she'd get in the shower, I'd go down and just drink a whole bunch and then hide the empty bottle. And I mean, I had beer. It was good. I figured I had to go out with glory. But anyways, with the first day I got there, something changed. Something had changed in me. God had already started working in my life again. I went up to everyone I saw and I introduced myself. And I tried to meet everybody. Within 2 days, I knew 80% of the nearly 50 people there. And that is a miracle because I don't like people that much. You know, before that, I like you all. Please trust me. But seriously. But this was strange because I wanted these people. I knew they were my people. I knew I was in the place I needed to be. And the first day I was there, at the first AA meeting, I shared. And that was really weird because I would have never done that. And I shared and I asked people the next day and they said, oh, yeah, Steve, you said some stuff. It didn't make any damn sense at all. But you know what? It was from the heart. I was like, cool. I'm good. And so, you know, while we were there for 35 days, I tried to share every day, and I started to understand. At first, it was, you know, silliness and bravado, but I was still scared inside, and I didn't understand the program. I didn't understand surrendering. When I got to the first step, I admitted I was powerless. That's the truth. I knew I was. Alcohol had kicked my ass. There was no doubt about it. My life was unmanageable. I couldn't go to work anymore. I blamed the job for my alcoholism. That was silly. At first, I really thought that because, and Rob will testify to this, that I would say, God, you know, my job is so bad. My job is just making me drink. My job makes me so tense. Da, 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 da. No, it wasn't my job. It was me. It was my attitude. It was my perception. That had been my problem all my life, my perception of things, how I saw them. And they weren't. That wasn't real. Things just weren't going the way I wanted. You know, they asked the question, we would have steel on steel where all the men would get together, and before, right before you got out, they'd ask you, are you trying to live life on Steve's terms or on life's terms? And that question was like, really more, it was weird to me. I was like, no, you have to live life on your terms. I have to live life on my terms, because that's the way a man lives. He makes the rules. He bends everything to him. And then I came to understand, no, you live life on life's terms. You accept or you change. And that's okay. And that is, and I finally understood that, but it took a long time. The second step, I went in believing that God could restore me to sanity. But I didn't want him to do that. But you know why? I had done this to myself, right? Why should God clean up my mess? I knew he could. God, he had done it before in 1996. I saw it happen. But I was ashamed. I was ashamed of how I'd let God down, how I'd let everybody down. So, of course, being a man, I have to do this. I can do this. That was my perception at that time. Then I understood when I got to step three, became willing to turn my life and my will over to the care of God. And that really saved me right there. That was when I started understanding the steps. God can do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And that is the truth. But he needs me to participate in it. He's not going to just do it again like he did. And so I'm so thankful for this program. The fourth step, that was an ass kicker. I worked with my sponsor. He told me to write a list of resentments. I should have read ahead what was going to happen. And so I had the most bitchin' list of resentments. And so I was ready to justify them. And then he just laughed at me. And he said, now let's look at your part. And I was pissed. And he said, you know what? You can fire me if you want. And I was just like... And he said, let's look at this. And I did. And then I realized. My eyes were open to what... That I basically... My self-centeredness, my selfishness, driven by 100 forms of fear all my life. And I had trampled on the toes of my peers and those who loved me, and they retaliated, and I had more resentments. Anyways, I got out of rehab. I showed up here at Howe Place on the first day at the 1 o'clock Brown Baggers. I've been trying to come every day since. I don't come on Sundays because I go to church. These are some of my beliefs. I believe that the elimination of drinking is but a beginning. I believe a simple kit of spiritual tools has been laid at my feet, and I plan on using them. I made the Breakfast Club my home group, and I'm so thankful that this group is my home group and my friends and people I can count on to help me. I've gone through the steps with my sponsor, and I plan on doing it again because I think that's important. I've showed up and suited up. I have tried to do what I can. I am going to be the AA Grapevine rep. Mary is done with that, and I'm going to try to fill her shoes. I have shared my experience, strength, and hope in meetings to the best of my ability, trying to help. I have learned to give it away is to get it, to gain. I have reached out my hand to newcomers. When I see a newcomer, I try to make them comfortable, and I try to make them feel that they're at home and this is where they belong. I have participated in group functions, and I found I can like most people. And I have learned to listen more than speak, and that's becoming even better in my life, because sometimes I really have something to share during a meeting, but sometimes I know somebody else might have something they need to get off their chest. And it's, you know what, I'm going to have, if God gives me this opportunity, I'm going to have a lot of time, a lot of chances to share, and it'll come. I have learned, like I said, I've learned to listen more and speak. I've learned that most everyone here in AA can share something beneficial with me. I've tried to be honest. I try to carry the principles of AA into every part of my life, into my work now. I try to keep things simple. I try to seek God's will in my life at the start of every day. I believe I am no longer running the show. I will ask for each and every 24 hours of sobriety, one day at a time, because I know that's all I've been given, is this is a daily reprieve, depending on my spiritual condition. To end, I'm going to just read something here. I would like to share just one last thought. I believe that within each of us is implanted, excuse me, a desire to want something so badly that we are never at peace. Mark Twain said, "You don't know what it is you want but you want it so much you could almost die. I believe I tried to quench that desire with alcohol to ease that empty feeling. I now believe that God, or a higher power of your understanding, is our heart's true home. St. Augustine stated, "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." Thank you for letting me share today. God bless you and keep you until then.